Is it birthday week? Yes, today.
I think that's a good move. What do you think, Jim?
Is it today?
Let's make the call.
It was yesterday.
Oh.
Where's the cake?
A call to order the Senate Jobs and Economic Growth Committee. First on our agenda today is Senate File 1701. Senator Cruz, why don't you come up to the table? I'm just trying to move things along, Senator Cruz. I see we have, in support of your bill, Mr. McElroy. Maybe if Mr. McElroy would join you as well. And Senator Cruz, I know there's an amendment. I know there's been some work and some earlier committee testimony or earlier committee action on this bill. So why don't you give us the highlights?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members. Thank you for having me here this morning. We do essentially today what we're going to do is we're going to delete out the portion that's actually pertinent to this committee. I do have an amendment, and I don't know, Mr. Chairman, would it be appropriate to move that amendment at this time, or would you like to hold off on that?
Thank you, Senator Cruz. Let me make sure everyone has the amendment. Is it, it's the A2, is that right?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Members, you should have the A2. Members, a quorum is present. Let's put the bill in Senator Cruz's order. So Senator Daly moves the A2. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed nay. A2 is adopted. Senator Cruz.
Essentially, Mr. Chairman, what you have left of this bill right now has to do with Health and Human Services fees to some of our restaurants for the inspections and the fees that our local counties can charge. Essentially, we had a thorough vetting of those in the Health and Human Services Department before it came to your jobs committee here. So I'm just kind of looking for some direction, how deeply you would like me to describe that. Do you need me to hit some highlights?
Maybe just a few minutes of highlights, and perhaps you and Mr. McElroy working together would be helpful for the committee.
Well, Mr. Chairman, thank with that, I would introduce my first testifier then, Mr. McElroy.
Good morning.
Mr. McElroy, welcome. Welcome to the Jobs Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Dan McElroy. I'm Executive Vice President of the Minnesota Restaurant Association. And the provision that remains in Senate File 1701 is a result of a concern about restaurant and other food service operators in the state about inconsistency of fees between those established by the Minnesota Department of Health and the programs where the fees are established locally. And it is an effort not to reduce local control and not to reduce the communication between regulated restaurants and their local regulators, but to provide some local accountability so that the fees follow a current provision in law that the fees don't exceed the cost of providing the service. And we can certainly provide a handout that shows how the fees vary, but just as an example, the fee for a what we call a small mom-and-pop restaurant in state-regulated areas are $270 a year, and in delegated authority counties range up to $1,047. And we certainly understand the counties may have somewhat different programs. They may choose to inspect differently. There are also counties I wish to acknowledge and thank whose fees are up to 25% lower than the state set fees, and we applaud that. We don't see the language in the bill as calling for a statewide fee schedule, but rather for a dialogue between the Minnesota Department of Health, regulated entities, and the delegated authorities. With that, Mr. Chairman, it's really a very simple provision. It's consistent with the requirement for state agencies that's been in place for more than 30 years that's contained in Minnesota Statutes Chapter 16A that simply says fees can't exceed the cost to deliver the service.
Senator Cruz, do you have other testifiers that you want to have on the record this morning before this committee?
Mr. Chair, we did not bring members to testify because we had done that in the Health Committee. And our understanding was that the purpose of this hearing was to take out the provisions that apply to the Jobs Committee and leave only the previously heard health fee section. So I did not ask restaurants to come this morning.
And that's fine. Thank you, Mr. McElroy. So maybe better for Mr. McElroy then, this bill has had months of work, and I know a lot of work at your association. and we're not quite done with it. There still are issues to go, so I just wanted to, maybe Mr. McElroy, you could summarize for the committee kind of the journey that it has taken and what it still needs to take, if that's a fair way to put it.
Mr. Chairman, this bill, Senate File 1701, started life as something of an omnibus bill we called the Restaurant Recovery and Job Creation Act. Because of committee jurisdictions and timing, we've elected to introduce new bills that cover the tax provisions and a job provision, a bill that was referred to your committee in the last few days, and to have Senate File 1701 only deal with this issue. And yes, we have this bill was originally introduced at the end of last session in the House. It's a result of a long dialogue with the Minnesota Department of Health and among our members. The next step for it is it will be heard in the other body, and then we would look forward to further discussions with the counties and have some suggestions from the county for the counties that could take place prior to the bill coming up on the floor of the Senate.
So, more to come. Stay tuned.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I do have at least one other name, and I think this is to testify in opposition. But like I said, Ms. Ring, are you here? So, Ms. Ring, based on what the author and the earlier testimony has been, we're going to, I guess I want to limit the discussion as to what's typically in front of this committee as opposed to what's been dealt with, say, in the health arena. We also have a commitment that this is going to be in front of us again, so maybe you will be in front of us again. But with that, welcome to the job.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Julie Ring. I'm the legislative coordinator for the Association of Minnesota Counties, and I will be very brief. I just feel compelled to share, I guess, on the county side of the story without getting into too much depth, since the bill was described to you and the portion that remains was described to you. The county's position on this bill is that the way it is currently drafted does allow the state health department to set fees for local delegated programs. We have made suggestions to the folks at Hospitality Minnesota and the author that we think would limit the bill to allowing the Department of Health to review fees, but that amendment was not accepted. And I think at the end of the day, the crux of the matter is we have a fundamental difference of opinion. The Association of Minnesota Counties believes that county boards and city councils should be allowed to set the fees for the programs they operate. We don't think state agency staff should have the ability to veto the fees that we set. And because that's sort of the crux of the matter, we have had conversations. I think Mr. McElroy and I have talked almost every other day for the last few weeks and have not been able to resolve that fundamental disagreement. And so I just wanted to let you know that the counties are opposed to the remaining provision in this bill. I know many of you have heard from your county boards and you've heard from your city councils about their concerns, and I'd like you to take that into consideration as you finalize this last committee stop for this language in the Senate.
Thank you, Ms. Ring. Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I know we're kind of straying off the purview of the committee here, but I just want to take an opportunity to put the members at ease, or at least present kind of the other side of that. The remaining legislation in no way limits local control. Essentially, what we're saying here is that the local units of government would not be able to charge in excess of what it would cost to do these health inspections. If there are, and there very well could be, other things that are being paid for currently out of the fees that are being collected, the local units of government would continue to be able to do that. They would just have to offer that fee under a different name. There are some great educational programs out there, training programs out there that we hope would continue to move forward. Essentially, what we're saying is here, let's make sure we're talking about what we're talking about. Let's limit these fees only to the cost of doing the inspections. If the counties or cities decide that there are other things that are important and that fees need to be levied for that, they will continue to be able to offer those fees just under a different name.
And, Mr. Chair, just to that point, I just point you to the language in the bill that says the agreement, which is written by the department, may specify the fees to be charged by the designated agent. That language to us says the department may specify the fees to be charged by local government. And I know there's a concern about the level of fees that local government charges. And I have a handout if it's helpful, but I don't need to bother you with more paper if it's not. But current statute 373.41 requires that county fees are commensurate with the cost of running the program. Current statute already requires that of us. And if there's a belief that counties and cities are charging fees that are exorbitant, it's already against the law. And so I don't know that we need this additional language, which we think is broader than is being explained to you today, to get at the crux of the issue.
Mr. McElroy, and again, we're beyond the Jobs Committee. It's interesting.
Well, Mr. Chairman, we'd certainly like to hold it to the Jobs Committee. I would commit to work with Ms. Ring. We don't agree, and we've offered some language that would indicate the state cannot set the fees or establish a statewide fee structure. The challenge is that the way fees are implemented today is quite separate from the provision, and we don't think it's reasonable to ask regulated restaurant staff to sue their regulator over fees. That we should have a more transparent and friendly system than that. But I would ask the committee to advance this because it no longer has Jobs Committee issues in it, and we would pledge to continue to work with the counties to find something that's mutually fair. We're going to be working with the counties for generations to come. We do not want to spoil that relationship.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know we have lots on the agenda, so I'll be really brief. I guess my question does have to do with the county and the local control, and maybe it's this isn't the venue for that. So my question would be, though, I don't know that we've heard this in local government, which is where this issue would be addressed. And so I'd be glad to address it now briefly, or is it going to local government? Or where's it going after this?
Senator Nelson, this is going to the floor. There's another piece of legislation that has been or is about to be introduced. There are, we'll say, negotiations and discussions going on.
Okay.
And this committee is just not the forum for that. On the last day of committee deadline,
I
don't want to venture into this too far.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Cruz is committed to working with these groups, and I'm sure he would work with you too.
Absolutely. I think that would be better than on the floor. So, okay. I'll look forward to working with you on that.
Senator Lilly moves that Senate File 1701 be recommended to pass as amended, as substantially amended, be recommended to pass, and move to the floor.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Torres Ray.
Thank you. My apologies for being a few minutes late. I have a handout here from Minneapolis. I don't know if they had a chance to speak. The city of Minneapolis did not have a chance to speak. I think this is an important...
Senator Torres-Ray, I didn't have anyone else ask or work with staff to ask to speak.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think that, Minneapolis has an important point in here in terms of the diversity of the local venues that may be impacted by this. Mr. Rainier is here, and I would like to hear who is here from the city of Minneapolis.
Can I defer to my assistant, Ms. Reed?
You have an assistant.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and Committee. I'm Senator Torres-Ray. I'm sorry, your question specifically.
Could you identify yourself for the
record,
please?
I'm sorry. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Melissa Reed, City of Minneapolis, Office of Intergovernmental Relations.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Reed, I don't know if you had a comment related to this bill.
Mr. Chair and Senator Torres-Ray, I believe Ms. Ring really did summarize kind of for on behalf of all local government what some of our concerns are. Minneapolis does have some specific concerns due to the unique nature of our community. We have a large immigrant community which runs several diverse restaurants, and some of our concerns are very specific that some of those restaurants have new types of food that don't fall under the food code that the State Department of Health currently uses, which I think has not been updated since 1994. So it really does kind of speak to, I think, Senator Nelson's point earlier about the local control issue and about communities being different and about
the need for some of our food inspectors, for example, to spend more time with some of our local restaurants because of potentially language barriers and cultural barriers and things like that that might cause our fees then to look differently than a community that doesn't have some of those unique aspects.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I wanted the city of Minneapolis to speak about this because I was part of some conversations that took place with the Department of Health really early on in Minneapolis when a machine to make tortillas and grind the corn to make tamales was put in a restaurant in Mercado Central. And it was clear that for the first time we were going to make tortillas here in Minnesota, and we were going to make tamales here in Minnesota. Now we have sambusas being made here in Minnesota. We have pupusas made here in Minnesota. And I can guarantee you that many staff in the Department of Health have not had those sambusas and pupusas and all of these new items that are really delicious. And I would do that. So anyway, Senator Cruz, I think that Minneapolis has a very important point. And, you know, really going through this process of inspecting these machines and figuring out, you know, really, they had to bring some people from Mexico to help with the process. And the business industry was very involved in that and the training that took place. And we've made a lot of progress, but, you know, a lot of this is happening now with the African community in Rochester, for instance, where we are opening more businesses, that are owned by African people of African descent. So I think that this is an important point, Senator Cruz, and I very much hope that you're able to work with the city of Minneapolis to work on this issue and their concerns.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Senator Torres-Rae, first of all, I mean, it's not even lunch yet. You're kind of making me hungry, all those descriptions. Rest assured, we do understand those concerns. And if you look at the way the legislation is written, it is not the intent in any way to create a one-size-fits-all fee structure. We completely understand that that's not feasible, that there are different barriers, and we allow for the flexibility of that. All we are simply saying is that you need to come to the table with an explanation of those costs. We don't want other things slipped in there. We don't want to be paying for necessarily educational pieces or training or things like that under the guise of an inspection. And I think there are legitimate concerns. We want our restaurants to succeed. That's why we're here right now. You're talking to a guy that's been in the restaurant industry for 16 years. I understand those barriers very, very well. And you'd be hard pressed to find somebody who's more supportive and wanting to see them succeed. As a matter of fact, we just want to make sure that they're only getting charged for services that are being provided. And if there is those communication barriers, if there are some of those other things, certainly we are going to take those into account.
Thank you.
Chairman. Very quickly.
Senator Tomasoni. We'll start counting. The clock will start.
If you already discussed this, then you don't have to answer it. But is the fiscal note, does it pertain to the bill as it was introduced, and some of the sections that were deleted have cost some money here, or is what's left costing the money?
Mr. Jensen.
Mr. Chairman, members, the fiscal note was drafted to the original bill, so I'll request a new fiscal note to reflect what's left in the bill.
On the Lilly motion, then, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion is adopted. Thank you, Senator Cruz, for the preview of the Health Committee and local government issues.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Let's take up Senator Nelson's. Let's finish Senator Nelson's bill.
Thank you, Mr.
Let's put it
Chair.
That way. Senate File 2355. Senator Nelson and staff, I know there's been some work done. I don't believe we need to take any more testimony, Senator Nelson. So if you could just summarize kind of where we are and how we need to finish this up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. I think I'm your frequent bill
today.
We're going to try to keep going here. If you guys have some conversations, please take it in the hallway. Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee. I'll just give you an update. Last evening, Mr. Nelson with Deed provided us with some new updated numbers regarding the performance of the Angel Tax Credit in Greater Minnesota and the metro area, and that's what this bill deals with. So these numbers were made available last evening, and as a result, we've prepared a new handout for you so you have accurate data that reflects these changes. And as you look at that, it's important to remember that even though Mr. Nelson identified the total dollar investment has increased, which is wonderful, you will see that that total dollar investment has increased, the actual number of businesses receiving a qualifying investment has just increased very slightly. And it has increased from 9% to 13% of the total. But it's the number of businesses receiving the investment that's the real marker for us to evaluate. The total investment number could be significantly swelled based on one or two new investments, but it's the total number of businesses that we should be trying to increase. And as I think we all have agreed, that that number remains disturbingly low for Greater Minnesota. So, Mr. Chair and Committee, I would like to encourage your support to increase this credit for Greater Minnesota and give a push to help create new businesses and balance the disparity so that it is truly a statewide program. Mr. Chair, I believe there are two amendments that we have to get the bill in the shape that that we have peace in the valley about.
Mr. Chairman.
Should I look to Senator Nelson or Senator Torres-Ray or Senator Metzen first?
We can start with Senator Metzen. It looks like he's ready to go there.
Senator Metzen.
Yeah, thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. We've talked about this before. And
Senator Metzen, I think we still need to hand out something if you're prepared to offer.
Oh, we have the A1
amendment.
We have
copies of the
pretty complicated.
Yeah, it's a complicated.
I think it's low for us.
Yeah,
for this. This is pretty complicated. This is
it's a big amendment.
You can figure this out.
How many words is it, Senator Metz?
Two.
Even do oral.
One. I thought it would be an oral amendment, Mr. Chairman, but I guess it's we'll wait till it's handed out.
Support the paper industry.
All right, Senator Metzen to the A1.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. This deletes 50 and inserts 40. We've talked about this before, and Senator Nelson and I and some of the members on the DFL side have talked about this. And when I was involved in this Angel stuff, we did – it was a statewide significant piece of legislation, and I don't think it's balanced out here properly. So we want to give just a little bit more advantage to Greater Minnesota. So we're changing it from 50 to 40, and I think it's the right thing to do. And the whole bill, I think, expires in a couple of years anyway, so it's not forever. So we'll see what if this helps a little bit. So.
Senator Metzen, Senator Miller's request a roll
call.
No.
Oh. Mr. Chair, I'm just curious how you're going to vote on this.
Senator's peace. Senator, so on the Metzen amendment, Senator Nelson, you are giving a
Chair,
thumbs up, I assume.
This is a great amendment. Peace in the valley.
There will be
on the A1, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. So the A1 is adopted. Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Senator Nelson. This amendment is a little bit different from what I proposed, but I'm okay with that because we have peace in the valley, and I'm good with that. So I offer the A2 amendment.
Okay, let's pass that out. A little longer than Senator Metzen's. And Senator Torres-Ray, per our conversation last evening,
thank you.
Was this then drafted to a different section, avoiding the data privacy issues that have been brought up?
Correct, Mr. Chairman. So what all this does is basically ask the department to collect information on women and minority-owned in the application. So we will have that information available to us for analysis in the future.
Senator Nelson.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to thank Senator Torres-Ray for bringing forth this amendment. This is an important piece of information that we need as we evaluate the effectiveness of this program. I know that's something we've worked on a number of times to make, and so I appreciate her support or her offering this amendment, and I would encourage support so that we can get the data and see how many of these small businesses are women or minority owned.
And I'd like to thank Senate Counsel for catching this and kind of juggling the language such that I think we're in a more comfortable place now going forward. So on the Torres Rey A2, all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed nay. A2 is adopted.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Kielash.
Yeah. Senator Nelson, one of the things I had a conversation with Mr. Nelson yesterday after our meeting, and I'm not sure that the intended effect by increasing to 40%, that means the cap that we have on the amount of credit available caps quicker with less availability to more businesses, because if you're giving a 40% credit, right, on it burns up the money faster for the same amount of work that we're able to do. So it may help out state, but it's also going to limit it, it's also going to restrict the number of businesses that can be funded this way, because it burns up the money faster than the 25% is. So I want to make sure that we're clear on that. So
Mr. Chair. Senator Kielash, I wondered about that very same issue. I think there's two things to keep in mind. One, Senator Michelle has a bill that's already sitting in the tax committee that adds $4 million to that pot of money. And so I think that alleviates some of your concern. And then the second item is just because the tax credit is available, if we don't know how that's going to play out. And so I think the intent is that we certainly would get greater participation in greater Minnesota. And I understand your comments.
Mr. Chair, this has the potential of having fewer businesses have the opportunity to use the angel tax credit. So,
thank you, Senator Kielash. Mr. Nelson, do you have no relation to Senator Nelson that I know of? Do you have further comments on this? Is this something that your department supports?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jeff Nelson, Angel Tax Coordinator for the Department of Employment and Economic Development. As we spoke yesterday, I think everyone realizes that we do wish to see greater investment in high-tech businesses in greater Minnesota. As I described yesterday, we began last year a very comprehensive sort of education program so that more businesses, more investors, more economic development officials throughout the state would become aware of the program. And I think as we talked through the numbers yesterday, we saw that that did have some effect. We are more than happy to work with the folks representing Greater Minnesota to try to increase those efforts. In terms of designating a proportion of the angel credit or a greater credit percentage for businesses in Minnesota, I just want to point out some – I'm going to sort of go back to Economics 101. In a perfect world, we would not need an angel credit. We have an angel credit because our surrounding states provide that type of thing, so we're trying to match what they do. But in a perfect world, we would be sort of a laissez-faire economy and let capitalism do its thing. However, we need to compete with our neighboring states, so we have an angel tax credit. We're already restricting in the angel program. It's not free market capitalism because we're restricting it to high-tech businesses. So in two ways, we're already sort of pushing against the free market philosophy by saying we're going to support certain types of businesses, we're going to support entrepreneurship. I think those are good things. They're all public policy. The more layers of restrictions that we add on to the program, I think we're getting further and further away from a free market philosophy. One of the biggest benefits, I think, of the angel program is that we, the state, are not deciding who is getting invested in. It's the investors that are making that decision. They're looking at what is the best use of capital, what has the greatest chance of success. And as we sort of tweak that and tweak that and tweak that, we're getting away from that. Having said all that, it is a public policy decision that if we want to tweak it further to help Greater Minnesota, the department will do whatever it takes to make that happen.
That was good, Mr. Nelson. All right, so Senator Nelson moves that Senate File 2355, as amended, be recommended to pass, and this will go to taxes, where this conversation will continue. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed
aye.
Nay.
Yeah.
The motion is adopted, Senate File 2355.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee
Thank
members.
Thank you, Senator Nelson.
You're good.
Senate File 1441, Senator Rosen. Speaking of angel tax credit.
I thought you were going to say, speaking of the angel.
We'll see after.
No,
We'll see after this bill.
To this bill. This is a good bill, Mr. Chair. And thank you again. It's so good to be in front of your committee.
Should have been dressed in white.
St. Patty's Day. St. Patty's Day.
Now, members, I am told that there is an amendment to this bill, but what's in your packets is an old version of the amendment. So it's an A1, is that right?
Yep.
All right, we're going to hand out an A1 now, and then when that paper works out, we'll have Senator Rosen address that. Senate Council.
Mr. Chair and members, the amendment is in substance the same. There were just a couple of typos in the original bill. So you'll see on line 1.22 and 1.23, a B is turned into a Ben and a he is turned into a the. So there were just some typos in the bill.
And Council, can you just make sure that could you identify the timestamp at the top so everyone knows that they're holding?
Mr. Chair, members, 8:24 a.m.
8:24 a.m.
That's a new one.
The A1, 8:24 a.m. So, Senator Rosen, we have the language in front of us, but we haven't even let you talk about your bill yet. So why don't you give us the highlights, please.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Good to be in front of your committee again. This is the demolition loan program. And basically, right now, this bill would allow loan funds to be awarded to local units of government where they have to remove blighted structures from the communities but don't have the immediate redevelopment plan for the site. We actually right now have the traditional redevelopment grant program, which works really well for sites where there is a costly detriment or issue with that site. But the need to develop the playing field between these sites and undeveloped sites still is a problem. And so there's we need to give some assistance with demolition and other redevelopment activities when either there is no current development plan, like the grant program, or a future development vision that in place, and that could affect the redevelopment for this whole community. In some cases, despite potential for future development, redevelopment, hazardous conditions, and other public safety factors may be a community's immediate concern. So in addition, securing and maintaining vacant, dilapidated structures is very costly. And for example, Mr. Chair members, in my little community of Blue Earth, Minnesota, there was a corner, beautiful structure on the corner of Main Street, and it was falling apart and the wall was caving in. They absolutely had no money to take care of that. And somebody in the private sector had to come in and give some money to take that building down because it was a public safety issue. And that's just not fair. So for these sites, DEED has developed a demolition loan program. And the loans would assist with the demolition activities, including interior remediation, such as asbestos abatement. And it would also assist with demolishing, and it would position this site for the redevelopment, creating jobs and increasing the tax base for communities. The loan parameters would be a loan with low interest at 2% for 15 years, interest rate for the first 2 years. The principal and interest payments start in the year 3 if the site has not been developed. If the site is developed, the remaining principal and interest would be up to 50% of the loan, which could be forgiven based on development benefits. and the property and buildings must be publicly owned. With that, we could go through what the amendment does to the A1 amendment, Mr. Chair.
Please.
And I have also Meredith Udoyback. Thank you. Udoyback with me. Sorry, Meredith.
No problem. Happens all the time.
So basically the amendment, number one, on lines 8 there, takes away the two semi-annual reports that are required right now and just goes down to one annual report. Saves some money. It's redundant. And it still reports back to the appropriate chairs. And number two, there is some flexibility in the grant program with the shall and the may on line 21 there. That so if the community is basing this redevelopment on a project coming in, and that's then if that project falls through, they do not have to pay it back. But I will let Ms. Udoyback handle
Rose,
that. Thank you.
If you can't say it,
I can't. Where's my coffee? I'm having some time this morning.
All right. Welcome to the Jobs Committee, and please state your name.
Yeah. Write this down better.
Thank you, Senator Rose, and Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. This happens all the time, so no worries. My name is Meredith Udoyback, and I'm the director of the Office of Brownfields and Redevelopment at the Department of Employment and Economic Development. Senator Rosen did a great job of explaining the demolition loan program, and just to reiterate, it would give us the ability to give out loans to projects that have old structures in their communities, but they don't compete through our redevelopment grant program because that program is so oversubscribed. That program gives out money to get rid of old buildings so that redevelopment can occur in cities where they're landlocked or they need to get rid of old buildings. Sometimes the communities don't have the development plan in place, and this would allow us to give out loan financing to those communities. So as Senator Rosen said, they can take care of some of those old buildings that are in the communities, causing crime issues. You know, they're detriments. They're sometimes at the beginning of a community when you drive in and they look terrible and the city wants to get them down, but right now they don't have a development plan. We could then give them loan dollars to take those buildings down, and at the point that they might get a development on the site, we could turn it into a 50% kind of grant. So that would be as though they had that development in place at the time the grant cycle would have occurred and they would have competed. For the amendment, as Senator Rosen said, the first part gets rid of a semi-annual grant report that we have to do, and we report also to the legislature annually on the grants that we do through our cleanup grant program. We think those reports become redundant. They are a cost to us, and we would just like to report once a year on the grants that we're giving out through that program. And then finally, the second part of the amendment in the demolition loan language, right now it says that if you get a grant on our grant side of the redevelopment grant program and your development should fall through. Right now, this language says that we have to go back and have communities repay us those grant funds. We would like the ability to perhaps be able to negotiate or think about whether or not we want to do that, because you know communities have all the best intentions of having redevelopments come on their sites. And in this time in with the economy, sometimes with all the best intentions, those developments might fall through, and we would like to be able to assess those situations individually, maybe ask for the grant funds back, but not be forced to do that if the conditions wouldn't warrant that.
Thank you, Ms. Udoyback. Senator Kelash.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, there's no fiscal note on this. Where's the money coming for this?
This would be, Mr. Chair and Mr. Senator Kelash, this would be general fund dollars, so there should be.
Senator Kelash, staff informs me that we have asked but have not received a fiscal note at this point. Maybe Mr. Jensen or Mr. Dorbeck could opine on this.
Yes, Senator, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we did do a fiscal note on it, so if you don't have it,
Do you have it?
back at the office, yes, I do.
You know what it says, Ms. Udoyback.
What else do I need?
Actually, it said that because this is policy language, that there wouldn't be a fiscal impact right now because the funds that would be given to the redevelopment grant program is what we would use then to either give out grants or these loans. So this language right here is simply policy. So we did not put a dollar amount in the fiscal note. And actually, it perhaps was pulled back because of that reason, if I remember right. The fiscal note came to us, and then I think it went back and said, no, you don't have to do it,
Mr.
because
Jensen,
it's policy.
Can you add some clarity to this?
Mr. Chairman, members, the appropriation is like $2 million in a special session last fall. And the governor's proposing, I think, $5 million for this fund in his bill. So there's a kind of a minimal amount of money available for this program.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The deed has been tracking the need for this out through that throughout the state. This is, I gave an example, Senator Kielesch, or just my little district, but you could go into any community anywhere and see a blighted structure that really holds up and hampers redevelopment. But I think the deed is saying there's about $18 million in projects that they've thought about so far to this point. And I should say, too, that this is includes authorities, including cities, counties, port authorities, housing redevelopment authorities, and economic development authorities.
Senator Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe a question for Mr. Jensen or Ms. Doybach. Is there money, is there currently funding available for this program from the last session, or is that money all spoken for?
Ms. Doybach seems to be moving towards the mic faster than anyone else. So, Ms.
Senator, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we currently have $2 million that we received in the 2011 legislative session, and we had some unspent bond proceeds that we had gotten from previous years. However, we are going to be awarding out all of that money hopefully on Monday of the next week. We had a grant round through the grant program. In January, we've just assessed those projects and are hoping to give out half that money to Greater Minnesota and half of that money to the metro area, which our statute requires. And then come Tuesday, we will have zero money in our account. We have a bill for $5 million of bond proceeds that's floating around. I do not believe that we made it into the governor's supplemental budget request to get general fund money for this program, which is really key. This program is to provide private redevelopment to create jobs and tax base. And when we have only bond proceeds to run the program, all we can do is put in public infrastructure on these sites. And the biggest costs that communities need funds for are to demolish the dilapidated buildings. Some of that infrastructure cost, the cities sometimes have other resources such as TIF and other mechanisms to pay for that, but it really is the demolition and other kind of pre-development costs that we pay for through this program that we need general fund dollars for. And in addition, we'd like to have this loan language passed. However, we can't run a revolving loan fund on bond proceeds because should these sites then be bought up by a private redevelopment and it's bond money, all those proceeds need to go back to the state and can't come back to the department for us to create this revolving loan fund.
Senator Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering, I think this is a good bill and a great idea to try and get some property, especially when they threaten public safety. Does this need to be done in a TIF district, or can this? A TIF district doesn't need to be created, correct?
Mr. Senator and members, no, it does not have to be in a TIF district. Sure. However, through the scoring system in the statute, we are asked to give more points to projects if they are in a TIF district, but you do not have to be.
Senator Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, because one of the concerns I have in the TIF district is sometimes, you know, they create the TIF district and there's nothing planned for it, and then 10 years goes by, 15 years goes by, and then someone wants to do something and there's not enough money left in the TIF district. There's not enough time left to complete a project.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and this has been a very good discussion, and I just just representing my district down in southern Minnesota, but you could go to any community in this entire state and drive through Main Street and see the potential there, see the problems, see the eyesores, see the beautiful old buildings that have been taken care of, that haven't been taken care of. The potential for this loan program is I think it would be greatly used out in my district and throughout the state. You just have to go down to Iowa, and they have made a tremendous push, and they've invested a lot of money to these small communities and making them attractive. And so you go to these little towns, and they've got cute storefronts, and everything's being maintained, and it just drives me crazy that Iowa is trumping us on this. I can't begin to tell you. So to us, it would make a big difference to have that loan program available for these communities to fix up some of these eyesores out there.
Senator Rosen, you're so competitive.
Well, Iowa, come on, Mr. Chair. I don't mean to offend anybody here, but I live 8 miles from Iowa, so I can say that.
Is there anyone else in the audience that would wish to testify on Senate File 1441? Senator Rosen, we're thinking this may need to go to finance. Was that your expectation?
Mr. Chair, it passed through the House, and it's in Ways and Means now.
Okay.
Chairman.
Senator Metz.
Senator Rosen lives 8 miles from my house.
Mr. Chair, that's a cabin.
I've driven by it.
You want a yard side location.
We're working on, Mr. Chairman, Senator Rosen has a great side location.
It's not working.
So I'm going to probably move this bill for you.
There you go. Senator Metzen,
Mr. Chairman,
Senate File 1441 as amended. You recommend to pass and refer to the Finance Senate Finance Committee.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Tomasoni.
It's been brought to my attention that we, I don't know if this is the right spot to do it, but that the money coming back from the loans might be, maybe should be deposited in a special revenue account as opposed to, is this going to the general, would it go to the general fund or where would the money, the repayment of principal and interest on loans and other income earned on money in the accounts maybe used for making grants and loans for administrative costs. Should they be deposited in a special revenue fund instead?
Senator Tomasoni and members, there was some discussion over about that, and right now you're right, it does just go back into the fund. I would guess internally we'd be tracking which of those are loan repayments and which of those are new appropriations into the program, but if that's something that you know the committee feels should be put in there, have a special revenue account for those monies to specifically be in a dedicated account, we would not have a problem with that.
Okay, well, Mr. Chair, I won't make the motion now because I'm not exactly sure what it is, but maybe somebody
maybe
can talk
finance.
With. Yeah.
That's probably a good idea.
Thank you, Senator Tomasoni. Senator Metzen renews his motion on Senate File 1441. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion is adopted. Thank you, Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members.
Thank you, Ms. Udoybach. So, members, we have one more bill on our schedule, but we do not have an author. Oh, I think we do have an author coming in. Great. I know there's multiple committees going on here. Good timing, Senator Thompson. Senator Thompson, welcome to the Jobs Committee.
Mr. Chairman, thank you.
Why don't we take up Senate File 2465, and if you could just hit the highlights, Senator Thompson, and then we have a number of people who wish to testify on this legislation.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. This issue was brought to my attention by the lady sitting to my left, Wendy Wolf, whose husband was a Minneapolis police officer. And he was a member of the bomb squad. I'll have her explain a little bit more detail about that and the specifics of the legal issue that we're dealing with here today. And he, several years ago, was unfortunately involved in a training incident in which an explosive was detonated in an area that caused sufficient concussion to result in a closed head injury. And again, I'll allow her to go into a little bit more detail on that. He is now unable to work, and he is managing, although he has an inability to do the things that would be necessary to return to work. So he is, in work comp parlance, permanently and totally disabled. It was brought to my attention that there is a strange quirk in the way the public employee retirement system works with the work comp system, so that someone in Mr. Wolf's situation is actually compensated at a lower rate than someone that is able to return to work. And I actually defended work comp claims for a number of years back in the late 80s and early 90s, and since have done some plaintiff's work, so I know my way around this a little bit. But even though I've been involved somewhat in the work comp system for many, many years, this particular problem never came to light for me until Ms. Wolf brought it to me. But as I understand it, and she can correct me if I'm getting some of the details wrong here, if a police officer is unable to return to work, then their work comp benefits are offset by the amount of retirement benefits that they can receive. That is true. That's the law. The part of it that's a little less clear to me, but as I understand it, if, on the other hand, a police officer is able to return to work but not in the role of a police officer, so say he or she goes back to a clerical position or something along those lines, that individual is able to collect whatever wage that they can earn along with the para retirement. And so we have this kind of quirky situation in law where somebody who is totally disabled and incapable of returning to work at all due to an injury sustained in the course and scope of their employment as a police officer is going to get less money and have a reduced income to take care of themselves and their family than somebody who is actually able to return to gainful employment it could be a very well-paying position. So I took this issue and went in front of the work comp board. Senator Lilly and maybe others in this room were there.
And Kielash, are you on that too?
I'm on the board. I was unable to go to that meeting because I was probably here.
All right, I'll forgive you then, Senator. But in any event, we discussed the matter there, and at that point, I didn't really know, members, if this was a work comp problem that needed to be solved or a pension problem that needed to be solved. And so the beauty of being in this institution is you can throw it in somebody else's hands, which is exactly what I did. And we've come up with the bill that is in front of you that we believe would resolve this. And essentially, I believe that it is technical enough. I might have Carlin go through this for us to more or less describe what it is. But if it pleased the chair first, I'd like Ms. Wolf to tell her story and get the committee members up to speed on the specifics of how these laws interact, that being the retirement law and the work comp law, to bring about what I think most of us would regard as not a particularly good outcome in terms of taking care of the folks who take care of us.
Thank you, Senator Thompson. So, Ms. Wolf, before we introduce you, so just to be clear with the committee, so it's the work comp, Department of Labor and Industry piece of this that brings it in front of this committee. We don't ever see pension matters per se, but there's definitely, we're trying to figure out how to sync these two up. I think those are the words you used, Senator Thompson, so it makes sense. Ms. Wolf, welcome to the Jobs Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As Senator Thompson said, my name is Wendy Wolf. My husband, Dan Wolf, was the bomb commander for the Minneapolis Police Department until 2005. He was working at a training in Robbinsdale, actually filling in for the city of Bloomington's bomb squad, who wasn't available. And they were doing interior breaching, where you put explosives on doors to blow them open, and they have to practice that periodically to maintain their proficiency. They do that in warrants and such, where suspects are barricaded inside of reinforced doors. And so he was doing this practice, and he had a little calculator that was given to him by the ATF, that where you punch in the size of the room and the size of the charge and the temperature and whatnot, and it's supposed to tell you whether or not it's safe. And it was a flaw in that calculator that said that it was a safe charge when it actually wasn't. And the blast, when it goes off, bounces off of the walls and then combines in different directions like waves in an ocean. And the calculator only calculated that first wave and not the bounces. Those bounces can result in spot pressures that are 10 or 20 times as high as what the calculator says. So the spot pressures concentrated right at my husband's neck and dissected his carotid artery, and that blast also went through his brain and disrupted the metabolism in the cells of his brain. So he has issues with memory and executive thinking skills. Stamina is a huge issue for him. His vision, he has double vision all of the time. So we tried to rehabilitate him to the point where he could do some work, but it was obvious that just wasn't going to happen.
And then we found out that this, through this loophole, after 2 years, when you reach maximum medical improvement, the city only has to pay a total of $25,000 in wage loss. All the rest is offset by the pension. So because his pension is more than what work comp would have paid, the city gets to walk away. They don't pay any wage loss after that first $25,000. There's another pot of money for how much you are disabled for loss of body function. And that one, those standards have not been changed in many years, so they don't really account for the unique nature of a blast injury where stamina is your biggest limiting factor. And so although he was found to be permanently totally disabled and need supervision for both cognitive reasons and mental health reasons, the grand total, and for the double vision, the grand total that we got was about $40,000. So that's what my husband's life is worth under the work comp system total. Currently. In 2007, my husband tried to commit suicide because that's the only way he could think of to bring in money for our family and stop being a burden, because there is no job that he can do. He's struggled with that several times since, and I am his only caregiver. I've been taking care of him for 7 years with no respite whatsoever. The only time I ever get away is if I can find friends or family to take care of him. I have not been able to work full-time because of my role as a caregiver. I've backed off on my work. I had two part-time jobs. Now I have one part-time job that's primarily at home. So my income is roughly half what it was before he got hurt. In 2008, Representative Holberg introduced legislation first to try to undo that loophole, and that got just sort of lost in committee and didn't go anywhere. And then through the Pension Commission, she came up with a increase in my husband's pension to 75% instead of 60% in the hopes of kind of filling some of that gap and figuring out later what the total solution would be. So we're back here today to try to get at that total solution. That 75% pension has not kept up because, number one, my husband never reached his peak earning years. It's based on the average of what he made between 2000 and 2004, and now there's only a 1% increase each year because of struggles in the pension fund in terms of being fully funded. So with our increased out-of-pocket health care costs, we're at roughly half of what he would be making if he were able to work today. And that was starting with a 75% pension 7 years ago. So, you know, we're back trying to fix this problem. It's very, very rare. In 2009, I helped found an organization called the Minnesota Association for Injured Peace Officers to reach out to other families where an officer has been severely injured so that they don't have to go through these things alone like we did. And so I've worked with some of the families that are the most severely injured in the state, and so far, there hasn't been anybody who's survived long enough to fall through the same loophole that we fell through. Chris Dewey passed away after a year and a half, so his widow, Emily, has been taken care of. There was another officer who was injured and was working so hard to try to get back to work that he was actually breaking down his muscles and getting worse. And he shot himself in 2010, so he never fell through this loophole. I'm not going to identify who that is because his wife very quietly buried him and didn't want the publicity of her husband committing suicide. There's another officer who was just injured in January who is in rehab right now that we don't know whether he will be able to work in any job or not. He has a very severe brain injury, and they don't know. It's too early to know what his full prognosis will be, but there is the potential that he could fall through this same loophole. But it is very, very rare. You either are able to work or you die, and people don't generally fall into this loophole that we've fallen into. So thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Wolf. I know the whole committee extends our sorrow by your husband's injuries and also our kind of amazement at your strength and
what you've had to go through personally. And I know Senator Thompson and the rest of the committee here would like to try to work something out here. Senator Thompson, I know there's some new language that has been drafted here as an amendment. Do you want to talk? Do we want to go to an amendment first? I also have some folks who'd like to testify. Okay, let's continue with the testimony. I've got Ms. Iden from the Department of Labor and Industry, and then I also have Deb Anger on behalf of the League of Minnesota Cities. So, okay, we'll go one at a time here. So, Ms. Iden, welcome to the Jobs Committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Chris Iden with the Department of Labor and Industry, and I'm just here to explain the role of the Workers' Comp Advisory Council in connection with this legislation. Senator Thompson and Ms. Wolf had come to a meeting of the council in February, and they had explained the situation as they did here. And at that time, there was no legislation drafted, but it was certainly the consensus of the council that something be worked out to resolve Ms. Wolf and her husband's issue. And it appears that this bill is that resolution. So in terms of the council looking at the issue, they were supportive of the issue being addressed.
Thank you, Ms. Iden. Ms. Somebody from the League of Minnesota Cities is going to talk.
Names today.
Thank you, Mr. Yes. Chairman. I'm Deborah Anger.
Sorry, Anger.
With the League of Minnesota Cities Insurance Trust. We support the use of the WCAC system, the Workers' Compensation Advisory Council, that is actually comprised of both labor and management representatives. The WCAC, it was our understanding, did not really further this proposal any further due to time constraints because of the complexities of the impact of this that this proposal might have. We would prefer that rather than circumvent that process, that this proposal be returned to the WCAC at a time when they have the time to actually research not only the complexities of this proposal, but the impact that it may have on cities and other public entities. We believe that the proposal will significantly increase workers' compensation costs to cities and other public entities with already limited resources and would put additional pressure on property taxes. This proposal specifically carves out enhanced benefits for just a few classes of public employees, which means that workers with similar injuries, private and public employees, would be treated differently. We also believe that the proposal will set a precedent that would continue to erode the current offset provision to the extent of eliminating it completely, ultimately having a significant impact on the entire insurance industry. The purpose of the permanent total disability benefits is to compensate the wage loss of a permanently and totally disabled employee, and that is one that is an employee who cannot engage in sustained gainful employment is kind of the legal definition of it. Para disability benefits also compensate the wage loss of permanently and totally disabled employees. In the case of Petuchek versus the City of Warren in 1995, the Supreme Court interpreted that the purpose of the offset was a means of preventing duplicate payments in systems aimed at wage loss protection. The quirk that Senator Thompson referred to in the system is not specific to para-disability. All workers within the state of Minnesota, public and private, who are declared to be permanently and totally disabled would have an offset against other governmental disability benefits like Social Security disability once a threshold of $25,000 in permanent total disability benefits has been paid. It is only in rare cases that people are declared permanently and totally disabled within the first year of their disability. It is not just folks with life-threatening injuries. It is folks with injured workers with maybe significant back injuries, shoulder injuries, other types of injuries where eventually, maybe after years of rehab or therapy, that they are declared permanently and totally disabled. So it is difficult to really judge the impact or to come up with exact numbers and say, well, this would only impact this many police officers or firefighters in a given year, because it takes so many years typically for that determination to be made. Once again, just because of the complexities of the workers' compensation system, we would like to see this proposal go back to the WCAC so that there's sufficient time to research it.
Ms. Andrew, I want you to keep going, but you actually just said the opposite of what I was thinking. It's because of the complexities of the workers' comp system that we need to find a resolution here, a solution here. And bouncing these people back and forth from the legislature to a committee to the pension commission to the Workers' Comp Advisory Council, to the Department of Labor and Industry, that is not going to be satisfying to this committee. I don't even think that's what you want. So,
well,
I apologize for interrupting you on that, but that stood out as that's actually why we're here, is to try to find something that makes sense in a pretty limited circumstance, from what I can tell. But please continue.
The fact that it carves this out for such few classes of employees, typically actually just two, it doesn't actually even apply to law enforcement officers like state troopers who do not receive paid disability benefits, or other state like Department of Corrections employees. And that's part of the issue as well, is that it is so specific that while it may address the issue that Wendy Wolf's husband is facing, it does not, if their system is broken and needs a fix, this doesn't actually do it. It's kind of a piecemeal proposal that doesn't really do that.
Thank you, Senator Dietzick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Wolf, thank you for your persistence in this. I agree with the chairman, and I would recommend that because this is so narrowly defined, we let this move through while you guys continue to work on the broader picture. Because otherwise she sits there in limbo for it could be a year or more, which is not fair to her and her family.
This a change in the workers' compensation system would not be retroactive. I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. I'm sorry, I'm nervous. I've never done this before. But.
You don't need to be. We're friendly here most of the time.
A change in the workers' compensation system would not fix Wendy Wolf's situation because the workers' compensation benefit statutes, when those are changed, they apply to dates of injuries that occur on or after that change in the statute. So it would address future, but not hers.
Senator Dietzick.
Okay, again, so this language would help Ms. Wolf and her family.
No.
It does not?
No.
This language here. Okay, thank you.
Senator Lilly.
Let's make it work.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, members, Senator Thompson, Ms. Wolf, specifically to Senator Dietzick's question and comment, this bill, this statute change, would not impact the families that have already been impacted by this narrow exemption or this narrow window that has not been filled. And I think that's part of the challenge that we face today, is what Senator Thompson is trying to achieve is he's trying to achieve that should this happen in the future, that families would be covered should this type of scenario happen again. And I believe that coming from the Workers' Comp Advisory Council that I do sit on with Senator Kielash, that labor participates in, that the chamber participates in, that business communities participates in, that our wish is that when we have a tragic, awful situation such as this that does happen in to peace officers, to others, that we actually do find a way to look backwards and fill this gap that has happened. I agree with Senator Dietzick that we ought to find a way to do this, and I've asked counsel to help me prepare an amendment to Senator Thompson's bill that would not only allow the bill to go forward and prevent this gap from happening in the future, but also would impact the families who have already had these tragic situations happen. And I would hope that we all could work together on this, and I'd look to counsel for some advice on the language for that.
Senator Daly.
If
following up, thank you, Mr. Chairman, following up with what Senator Lilly just said, in the Pension Commission, we do hear frequently some of these one-time exemption, exception kinds of things, and I see that Ms. Vanek is in the back. I would like to hear, if we could, at some point, what the Pension Commission, well, not the Pension Commission, but the executive directors of the PARA board thinks about this.
Absolutely. So we got a little time. We can take some more testimony, and then I know Senator Lilly and Senator Kielash have been working on some language. So, sir, we haven't heard from you yet, and I don't even know your name, so if you could just identify yourself for the record, and welcome to the committee.
I need to identify myself. Thomas Peterson. I'm the senior workers' compensation defense attorney at the League of Minnesota Cities. Obviously, I'm here at the table right now. I was up here. I'm with Deb Anger.
Gotcha.
And if there were any legal questions, I'm supposed to be here to just help her out.
So you're good to go.
I'm good to go.
Okay.
Thank
Is
you.
There, let's see, Ms. Vanek, let's take your testimony. And Senator Daly, thank you for noting that.
Okay, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Mary Vanek. I'm the director of PERA. I'm not here to speak to the first section of this bill that's related to workers' compensation, but I am here to speak to the second section, which is related to the benefits we provide. The total and permanent duty disability provision was added to our statute in 2007 after we did some extensive work on our disability program for the Police and Fire Fund because it was structured such that it provided benefits beyond what we believe was reasonably intended. So we tightened it up significantly, but in dealing with a number of very serious cases, we added this additional provision. The total and permanent disability provision exists in our law because under the IRS code, it provides that those benefits are then payable tax-free for life. Which are normal disability benefits are not payable tax-free for life. They become taxable when an individual reaches retirement age, which is 55. So this provision was put in much because of the situation of the Wolf family, that there are serious injuries. I can tell you today that there are six individuals collecting a total and permanent duty disability benefit out of the Police and Fire Fund. And there's only one individual currently being offset. And Mr. Wolf was offset to the tune of $1,100 on our side of the equation during his receipt of benefits and his ongoing receipt. There's no offset on the PERA side of this right now. My concern is this. I've been with PERA 37 years. I've been director 15 years, and every time we open up one thing that we believe is inconsequential because it will be limited to a few people, there is always a push to extend it. We have a number of people on regular duty disability benefits in the Police and Fire Fund who are being offset, and that saves the fund over $400,000 a year in payments. They receive, in combination of their duty disability benefit from the Police and Fire Fund and their workers' comp, an amount equal to the compensation for the job they were holding at the time of their injury, and that is tracked as that salary increases. So the salary increases above where the workers' comp and the para benefit are less than the salary, there's no offset. And so I do respect what Mrs. Wolf is going through. I applaud her for being as brave and as diligent as she is, but I do have concerns about impacting the PERA statute without the Pension Commission having a thorough review. I'd also like to clarify that individuals who are not totally and permanently disabled, who are disabled from performing law enforcement or firework, can go out and work. We do track their earnings regardless of where they are working, and they are not allowed to get a benefit if their benefit plus their earnings are more than 125% of what they would have been earning had they not become disabled. So to eliminate the offset altogether rather than looking at bringing it up to that 125% threshold, I think is something that typically falls in the purview of the Pension Commission because it's related to our law.
And I agree with that. Ms. Vanek, and it's the work comp piece that starts the discussion here, and I hope that there's a way, with all the brain power in this room, that we can do something that makes legal and fiscal and even actuarial sense, but still provide something for this family. It is a complex technical maze, and to force people to fight their way through our processes and legalese here, it just seems like, you know, adding further harm to injury. So I appreciate you being thoughtful and creative on this, and it would be my intent, depending on what we can fashion here, that indeed this issue will go to local government. We've asked the Pension Commission if and how they want to review this. So this is just the start, but there's been some good work already. Let me ask Senator Thompson.
Oh, Mr. Chairman, actually finish your thought because I wanted to respond to some of the things that have been said, so please complete your thought.
I was just going to ask if there were others who wanted to testify, Senator Thompson, but if you want to add something while this gentleman comes to the table, that'd be fine.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Just a couple of things to point out. And I understand the concerns that exist here. In fact, in the interest of full disclosure, back when I was a defense lawyer, I represented Ms. Danger and her company, actually, and we worked together. So I think I, as having been a work comp defense lawyer for about 6 years, I think my reputation for fiscal conservatism is a little bit unassailable. I come with some street cred here. I think in this instance we're looking at a unique situation for a couple of reasons. Number one, this is a very small class of people, and we are looking at police officers and firefighters. I'm certainly willing to talk about highway patrol, whatever. If I've missed a category of people that ought to be in here, we can talk about that. The number of people in this situation is so small, I just can't believe that the cost would be that high. You literally have to be in a situation where you, thank God, didn't suffer a fatal injury and yet suffered such a significant injury that you're incapable of returning to work. So in my judgment, the impact on an individual and his or her family is really significant in comparison to any impact upon the finances of the fund paying it. And in terms of the comments made by Ms. Vanek, I would be willing to talk about, you know, putting some reasonable caps on this that would be reflective of the same thing that you have for individuals that return to work. The idea here is not to give anyone a windfall, believe me. Nobody in this situation is getting a windfall. The idea is to not leave this incredible illogic where somebody who is in Mr. Wolf's situation is not taken care of financially as well as somebody who was not injured as severely. That's what we're looking at. Also, I would point out, and I think that I think I would not be out of line to say that every member of this legislature, Democrat or Republican, acknowledges the difference that exists for the people who strap guns on or go into burning buildings to protect us. And that's the group of people that we're talking about. And I think that that group of people needs to be looked at a bit differently. Thank you for your allowing me that time.
Welcome to the Job/Work Comp Pension Committee.
/Healthcare.
Actually, this morning you were health, too. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Forgive our informality, or at least mine, but welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Edward Reynoso. I'm the political director for Teamsters Joint Council 32, and I speak on behalf of our 62,000 active and retired members in the state of Minnesota, many of them which happen to be in the law enforcement industry. You know, I know that it may look somewhat odd to many of you right now, and I suggest you take a picture.
That's
because I suggest you take a picture because while our organization fundamentally disagrees with the vast majority of Senator Thompson's proposals in this body, we are actually united on this issue.
Oh.
Now, okay, one picture.
Sell that on eBay. That's gonna be
I come here to testify in favor of Senate File 2465 because, in our opinion and our members' opinion, there are heroes out there that are being shortchanged, not only the heroes, but their families. Now, we wish we didn't have to have this type of legislation to protect firefighters and police when they're injured permanently, but the reality is that we do need it. The fact is that it is a dangerous job, and as such, we need to have specific protections to protect them. You know, it isn't like having a job as a police or a firefighter isn't like being a truck driver or being a factory worker. When many of our truck drivers, when they jump into a truck and they see it's unsafe, by law they can say, I'm not driving this truck. The brakes are bad. The signals aren't working. Whatever the situation is. Firefighters and police officers don't get that option. They don't have an opportunity to say, I'm not going to that shooting scene. It's too dangerous. Give me the next call. They don't have an opportunity to say, I'm not going in that building. There's no way. It's unsafe. Give me the cat and stuck in the tree call. The reality is, as they put their life on the line every single day when they go out to protect us. When we pick up the phone and call 911, we're either looking for help to rescue us, or we're looking for them to put their life on the line. And doggone it, this is simple for us and our members. This is about workers. This is about protecting police officers and our firefighters that put their life on the line for us every single day. Now, I just want to bring out a couple issues, a couple stats. And just recently was brought to my attention. Every single year, 150 police officers are killed in the line of duty. It's sad, but it's true. Every single year, 150 police officers are assaulted. Every single year, 10 are shot at. I'm sorry, every single day, 10 are shot at, and 150 assaulted. This isn't an easy job, and quite frankly, for me, you couldn't pay me enough to do it. But these men and women do it because it's in their blood. It's what they do. It's what they believe in. They believe in saving people's lives and protecting us. There's a reason why on the side of many police officers it says protect and serve. That's precisely what they do. Bottom line, we need to do the same. When our servicemen and women come back from war, we need to take care of them. They're our heroes. So are our police and fire. You know, I understand it's very rare. And it's very rare that we're going to have to cover some of these injured officers and firefighters. But in the event that we do, we have a fundamental responsibility as a society to them. And we must not shortchange them and their families. They are our heroes. And we need to treat them as such. We ask my organization, and I personally ask every single one of you to support this Senate File 2465. It's the right thing to do. It's the responsible thing to do. And if you just listen to Mrs. Wolf's story, you can't help but share in her pain. Let's make sure nobody else has that same sort of pain as her and her family have experienced. Now, I'd like to change my hat. I have different roles. I introduced myself as the Teamster representative. Earlier, mention was made with regards to the Workers' Comp Advisory Council. Changing my hat and telling you, I also sit on that board with Senator Lilly and Senator Kielash. And I can tell you the distinct conversation was that we need to do something to fix this. This fixes it. Let's get it done. Let's get it done now. Thank you.
Senator DeCray.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I want to speak in support of this bill for a number of reasons. I guess I look at our nation's military as folks that are doing a similar thing, and I think our nation is trying to do the right thing by our veterans and our military people that are hurt. And I do put our nation's police force and fire departments in the same category in my mind, and I think we have to do the right thing to take care of them and their families. I want to address a comment to Mrs. Wolf. I can feel your pain somewhat. My wife and I have a son that's disabled who lives with us at 32 years old. And without respite care, you do an awful lot of heavy lifting. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator DeCrieff. So I want to turn then to, I start with Senator Lilly, who I know has been working on language, and I guess remind the committee, so when we have a work comp issue in front of us, the two places we would first look would be to the Advisory Council, which has had some conversation and wants to do something. Then we'd look to the Department of Labor and Industry, and they seem to be giving us a green light. So, Senator Lilly, what do you have for us on this bill today?
Mr. Chair, members, I'd like to ask Senate Counsel for assistance. Again, the bill, as it currently stands, does address future situations, future challenges, problems, but does not address those who have already been impacted by these situations. And we are trying to find wording that would allow that to be covered. Senate Counsel.
Yes, Mr. Chair and members. As mentioned earlier, I understand that this provision cannot apply retroactively to previous dates of injury, but the amendment I was talking about with Senator Lilly, let me just read it, and I guess I would want to know what the comments would be regarding to whether or not this can actually work, but the amendment would read, after line 2.9, I would insert an effective date, and it would read as follows. This section is effective the day following final enactment and applies to all future payments regardless of the date of injury. So it would not require that retroactive payments would be made retroactive to make the individuals whole, but to all future payments regardless of when the injury occurred.
Prospective.
Can you repeat at least the language of the amendment as you're envisioning it for members and for Senator Thompson?
Okay. After line 2.9, insert an effective date. This section is effective the day following final enactment and applies to all future payments, regardless of the date of injury.
Senator Thompson.
Mr. Chairman, just so I'm clear that I understand it, Ms. Fontaine, so it, in other words, no fund would be required to pay retroactively back to a date of injury. There would be no big lump sum payment, but upon the effective date, then an individual, regardless of the date of injury, whether it's in the future or back, would start to be subject to the statute.
That is correct, Mr. Chair and Senator and members and Senator Thompson. Their benefit payment would no longer be offset or reduced. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, if that's Senator Lilly's intent, I would certainly consider that a friendly amendment and be supportive of it.
Senator Lilly.
That is my intent.
Okay, so Senator Lilly will be offering that as an amendment. I guess it'll be an oral amendment. We'll go over it once more. Senator Kielash, did you have your hand up?
No, I didn't. Supportive.
I think we could vote.
Oh, you could say that. All right.
Excuse me, I apologize.
Please, join us at the table.
Yes, Karen Ebert, I'm staff counsel with Minnesota County's Intergovernmental Trust, and I just note that you are affecting all work comp claims that are currently paying out PERM total benefits. That includes highway workers, community action work. It includes a vast amount of employees that are currently receiving benefits, not just police and fire. With that amendment, so if I could speak, it's like if you want to help Wendy Wolf in her situation, you should limit it to that fact situation for the retroactivity. Otherwise, we haven't had time to even put numbers together. I mean, we hear from Ms. Wolf that it's a few amount of claims that will be impacted by this, but fact is, it is so complicated. And every claim, every work comp claim is different. Every settlement involves all these negotiations. So it's not an easy comparison to do. So it's hard for us to agree that it's a small number of claims that will be affected. And I think that would be worth it if we could actually sit down and calculate the financial impact.
Senator Tomasoni.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It seems to me that Section B is specific to the police and fire plan. And so why do you think that the effective date ends up affecting everybody?
Because it's in the work comp statute. 2.9, line 2.9. Oh, it does say police and fire.
And we apologize because we're trying not to do this on the fly, but and we're doing some of this with an oral amendment that you can't always see. So, but I think that was definitely counsel's intent, was that it only apply in that kind of a situation.
Mr. Chair, members, and Senator Tomasoni is absolutely right. This would apply only to the changes. But if need be, I can insert to all future payments to members of the Public Employees Retirement Association Police Fire and Plan under paragraph B, if we want to make explicitly clear. But I think that the way I stated the effective date earlier was it's just to the new language.
Senator Tomasoni?
Well, that's I think the witness agreed too just now.
Senator DeCray.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have a question. Does this also include like State Patrol and
they're not part of para?
Or it does not. That's a whole different area.
Counselor,
I think it is.
Mr. Chair and members, I believe they're not part of para. I think they're outside of this particular plan.
Did we move your amendment?
Okay.
We have not. Senator Howe.
Mr. Chair, I think your additional clarification, the Senate Counsel, would be good. You know, that I think that would just, why leave it open? Just add it. Let's be clear on it.
So, Senator Lilly and or Senate Counsel, can we, let's be clear and put the Lilly Kielash amendment clearly on the, before the committee. Lilash.
Mr. Chair, members, one more time. I'll just read it. So we'll insert an effective date after line 2.9. This section is effective the day following final enactment and applies to all future payments to members of the Public Employees Retirement Association Police and Fire Plan, regardless of the date of injury.
Thank you.
Senator Thompson.
Mr. Chairman, I still consider that a friendly amendment and would ask the committee to support it. That was certainly the intent. It was not the intent to broaden this beyond that class of employees.
To the Lilly motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion amendment is adopted. So Senator Thompson, still a ways to go. I think I misspoke earlier. This would need to go to state government. And I think, are you a member of that committee? So
I am, Mr. Chairman.
You'll be able to watch that, and I think Senator Daley is going to be in a position in a couple places, including the Pension Commission, to watch this. Senator Thompson, final comments.
Yes, and Mr. Chairman, obviously I would ask that somebody on the committee move the bill, but I would like to point out to the members that I certainly will talk with the Pension Commission and do the best that I can to make certain that this legislation ends up in a form that doesn't in any way risk the integrity of either our para system or the work comp system. That obviously is not the intent of this legislation. It is simply to address a specific problem, and the members can rest assured that all of us are speaking openly and trying to solve the problem, and we'll continue to do that as this makes its way through the next committee.
Senator Howe?
So I'll move the...
Oh, no.
I think the cry already beat you.
Oh, did he?
Senator Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think it is important for our committee to hear those numbers from the previous testifier. I didn't catch her name. But when those numbers do become available, I think it's important for us to know how many people are affected by this. So if we could get that information when it's available, we'd certainly appreciate it.
So, Senators DeCraif, Howe, and others.
Oh, I'd like to do it.
Move that Senate File 2465, as amended, be recommended to pass, and move to the State Government Committee. Senator Tomasoni.
One final comment, and I know this is your intention, Senator Thompson, but the biggest reason for the Workers' Compensation Council is because whenever there's a workers' comp bill that has the ability to be amended, that it puts up a huge red flag, and all of a sudden people are throwing all kinds of workers' comp amendments on it. So I hope you'll do your best to fight off any possible amendments that might possibly come along for this bill, because it could potentially have that effect. And
good point.
And I just want to make sure that we just pass this as it is.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Tomasoni, rest assured my intent with this piece of legislation is to address this problem and this problem only, and it would be improper in my view to try to make any changes in the workers' comp law beyond the scope of what the council has talked about and what this committee has talked about. So you have my word. I will resist any attempts to change the nature of the bill through amendment or otherwise.
Thank you, members. All in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Motion is adopted. Thank you, Senator Thompson, for all your work.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members for your attention.
We have multiple potential committee meetings next week as deadlines continue to surround us. We certainly have our normal Tuesday, Wednesday times, but we may need a few more. Appreciate all your work this week with the additional committee time. Committee is adjourned.
I guarantee that.
Yeah, need all those
I know.
I'm not going to live that long.